on page 180 time to get into our weekly TV recaps of the second half of Invincible Season 2 with Dan Lynam and Kev Keane joining me. Plus, I'm going to catch up on some other TV, including Celebrity Big Brother, Masters of the Air and Shogun. All that and more still to come. Very welcome to another edition of Page 180. And guys, before we get into our first TV show that we're going to be recapping every single week, of course, for Invincible Season 2, can't wait to chat to Dan and Kev very, very shortly. I do want to catch up on some of the shows that I've been watching and kind of clue you in on some of my thoughts there, as we've been doing every now and then here on Into the Spoilerverse. It is Into the Spoilerverse this episode, but I will be doing these shows without spoilers. These are more recommendations if you haven't checked them out, or thoughts if you have, but they are spoiler free, so don't worry about that. Well, except for the first one, which is a reality TV show, so that doesn't really count, because are you really going to go back and binge every episode of Celebrity Big Brother, which I'm recording this now after Friday's eviction, so you'll probably hear it after Sunday's episode, but I haven't seen that at the time of recording. And as anyone who listened last year knows, I am a huge Big Brother fan. I actually auditioned for it at one stage in a previous life. And ITV's reboot of the series last year was a huge success for me. It made my top 10 TV shows of the year. So, of course, I'm watching the celebrity version this year. And admittedly, I was a little bit underwhelmed by the initial lineup for this year, which seemed like they kind of blew the budget on Sharon Osbourne and Louis Walsh and then got a bunch of no-names in there. Ekin-Su, probably the most recognizable of the rest, but even then, I'd never heard of her until then. But as we head into the final week, the formula for Big Brother just works. And it feels like ITV and the producers of the show really have their arms around this format. As last week, Big Brother decided to kind of twist the knife with face-to-face nominations. And then you had Jelly Bean Roulette, where they had to either eat a sweet or a sour one and say something sweet or sour about the other housemates, shaking up the kind of boring harmony of the house that nobody wants to see. The unraveling of Ekin-Su, which was kind of the main takeaway from all this, who seemed to have a little bit of a princess complex before then of I'm beautiful and always the center of attention in every room that I go into. I'm a digrade, and isn't life very easy to be nice and to be this person that I want to be? That's exactly what I want from Celebrity Big Brother. Like, let's take these people who are kind of used to the public spotlight, putting on their kind of Disney smiles because they know it gets votes and how to play this game, especially kind of reality star veterans like Ekin-Su. Let's put a camera on them for 24 hours, challenge them mentally and deprive them of kind of the levels of sleep and food that they're used to, and see if their mask slips. And that's exactly what happens in Ekin-Su's case. Face-to-face nominations proved to be the end of her, as she nominated someone who seemed like her best friend in Louis up to that point, and then flipped the fuck out after being nominated by someone that she thought was her friend in Marisha. The hypocrisy, the tantrums. She turned around at one stage and was like, "You can wear the crown." It was delicious. And we saw her go in 24 hours from someone who you could see putting a run together and potentially winning the whole thing just by being one of the actual celebrities people know, to evicted in 24 hours. It was phenomenal. It's a huge endorsement for how, on kind of image-centric, highly edited and really fake environments like Love Island, you can control your image and put that best foot forward, but not in the Big Brother environment. The Vote to Save element that they've got this year is also fun, meaning that we've kept the likes of Louis in. And I say that not because I particularly like Louis, like his bitchiness and toxicity is having the likes of Jedward amazingly come out and tell all of his secrets while he's in there. But with Sharon having left now was kind of the celebrity lodger, because they didn't want to put her up for eviction because they knew that like her past kind of sins would probably rob them of their most entertaining housemate. But with her gone now, we'd be left pretty stuck for good TV moments in the last week of the show without him. The reality is, though, that the people left are kind of, for me, the worst kind of Celebrity Big Brother housemates, the kind of generic, loud, but really empty and vacuous people who are just dancing and singing loudly, kind of desperate for attention, but without a single actually interesting thing to say. And with that in mind, I looked at the contestants this morning, and I guess I want either Fern or Zizi to win just by not being that kind of prototypical annoying housemate, but also I actually don't want either of them to win. So as we head into the last weekend, like I said, I haven't seen Sunday's episode, which you may have when you're listening to this, but that's kind of Big Brother's challenge and job to make us give a shit about these housemates, which, to be fair, they did last year anytime we lost a big personality, and give us enough reasons to care for a deserving winner to emerge. If they do that, then for me, they'll have another unqualified successful series on their hands. Moving on into the more fictional dramas and so on, Masters of the Air wrapped up this week on Apple TV. I reviewed the first half of the series in my last TV catch up if you want to check that out. And it obviously finished its mini series run on Friday. And there are certain things that when you talk about Masters of the Air that are benchmarks for this show and just remain universally true because that's the show's DNA. For example, it looks absolutely spectacular. This is a show you need to watch in Ultra HD on the biggest screen you can find, and the air battles in particular are cinematic and breathtaking throughout. The period element of it too is fantastic, with amazing kind of costume and set design, making you feel like you're actually living with these people in World War II at times, in a way that kind of romanticizes it. Like, it feels like an old school war story, but at the same time, it romanticizes it without glorifying it as well, without making it as simplistic as kind of the heroes and the villains and the good guys win and the bad guys lose and stuff like that. So the technical aspects are really on point, and it knows how to kind of rev up the adrenaline when it comes time for shit to hit the fan. So the question that I spoke about in the first review of this was, when it comes to Master of Air, was always around if it could get into your heart, if the characters, their hopes, their wishes, their dreams, and their desires connected with them. And there's a lot of characters, so that's a big challenge to do. And in the end, on reflection, the answer was kind of. Like, the show definitely didn't fail. Like, I did love tuning in every week for the last few weeks, and there are some absolutely amazing episodes. Episode 3, one of my favorite episodes of the year. But whereas around that stage from episode 3 to 5, it felt like it's kind of found its groove, the last 4 episodes for me kind of lost its scope a little bit with the story, to the point that it didn't really feel like the same plot that we started with. Like, episode 1 doesn't really feel connected to episode 9 beyond some of the same characters being there. It doesn't feel like it told one long story. Like, in episode 8, for example, we introduced a largely black squadron that we'd never met before, have no attachment to. And you look at them and you're kind of like, wow, like, you probably could have done an entire show on them. Maybe that could have been series 2. It felt like they kind of yeah-yeah'd a lot of their story and left it up to us to imagine. Like, even kind of there was a point where they were talking about the racism that they undergone. And one character kind of just drew a line with it. And he's like, yeah, I know what my country is, whatever, but I'm still fighting for it. And that was it. And I'm like, okay, I feel like you could have got in deeper there. And it's kind of the risky nature of trying to do a mini series on war stories covering a really wide berth of time. And this essentially covers 2 full years from 1943 to 1945 at the height of World War II. So a lot of the characters that we met in the beginning die. That's not a spoiler. It's a war story. Come on, you knew that was going to happen. Which again, like, in the initial episodes when that happened, these are the people we've been introduced in. We're like, oh, that's probably going to be a main character. It made it really shocking, and it made it kind of, I don't want to say entertaining television, but you know what I mean. But then you kind of felt like as they were getting towards the end, they had to kind of recycle characters and just parachute people in to just fill airtime and fill everything out. And there were points where I actually couldn't remember who this person was or what their relationship to our kind of core 3 characters was and how they fitted into the grand scheme of things. Like I said, there's no really massively coherent narrative beyond, wow, look at the full scale of war, which, like, yeah, we know, like, war is big and it's horrible, especially a world war. But when the show zooms in into individual missions, like, this person needs to get from here to here, and here's where the Nazis could just mess everything up, then it's quite fun and effective. And there's a lot to like even about how the show has compassion for everyone involved. Like, even, like, Nazi soldiers, it doesn't say that the Nazis are good people or anything like that, but, like, even Nazi soldiers, they kind of paint as these are real people caught in a war. Everyone is a victim of war, which is kind of a take on war that I like, rather than just good guys here, bad guys here. You know, this is my country is good, your country is bad, which I don't know, it's too simplistic for me. And Masters of the Air straddles that line kind of well. But when you ask me what Masters of the Air is actually about in general, all I can really say is war and planes and Austin Butler being a really good alpha male. Like, I just, It's like I said, it's not that it didn't work. I looked forward to watching it every week and I enjoyed every episode. It just felt a bit off, a bit. Sorry, it just felt like it bit off a bit more than it could chew in one season. I'd have liked kind of both halves of season one to be kind of split into their own seasons and the characters involved to be fleshed out, because it does feel like you have a completely different cast heading into the second half. So that the high points could truly hit emotionally. But look, if you like war stories or if you're into Top Gun or anything like that as well, Masters of the Air, it's a good show. I'd recommend it, but it's just not the home run that I maybe hoped or wanted it to be. Speaking of the show, I'm gutted won't have more than one season, but this time only in a positive way. Let's talk about Shogun, which has rocked my world since debuting on Disney Plus a few weeks ago. Husband and wife creators Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo poured water, unfortunately, on a lot of people, such as myself's hopes, by revealing that season one of the adaptation will cover all of James Clavell's iconic novel about European invaders of Japan turning the tide in a political civil war, and that season two isn't currently planned. And that's devastating because the show is fucking phenomenal. And if you haven't, you need to get on board with this ASAP. And since Game of Thrones limped to the finish line, there have been so many shows that kind of fancied themselves as the next Game of Thrones. But for me, this is the first one that seems like it can actually hold up to the lofty expectations that that sets in your mind. It's impossible not to think about Game of Thrones when you see a show that's filled with political kind of palace intrigue and a race for power among fascinating characters whose motives aren't always clear. And then you have shocking and vicious twists while even making time for some fucking and laughing along the way. Quite early into this, it becomes clear that Cosmos Jarvis is going to become an absolute superstar from this, with his turn as British sailor Blackthorn. His line delivery is sensational, with every kind of overemphasized word, spitting rage, patriotism, and moxie all in one. And his confusion and ignorance to Japanese culture also brings some much needed levity to it. Like when he became at one point convinced someone was a warlock, and he was like, "What is the warlock saying?" And they're like, "We don't even know what a warlock is." Lord Taranga, played truly by Hiroyuki Sanada, is a classic Game of Thrones enigmatic leader type, keeping his cards really close to his chest, his mind full of plans and schemes that he's not making the viewers or even those around him privy to, but clearly a mastermind capable of doing everything possible to get out of what looks like an impossible political situation that should, in theory, lead to his death. There's some obvious plotting going on here. Like at times, there's a love story central to the plot, but the woman involved is married. So you can kind of already, with that setup, do the maths on what's going to happen there. But ultimately, you forgive it because it's so fucking thrilling and fun minute to minute. It is like the world building in it is first class. Like you learn about shocking Japanese customs through horrific plot twists, such as in the opening episode, we learn about seppuku, where one of Taranga's men kind of speaks out of turn during an important daimyo meeting, and for punishment must kill himself and his child. Fuck. That's not a huge spoiler either. Don't worry, like that's just something that's kind of thrown away. I'm not giving away a big plot twist there. And the benefit to it being a miniseries, as much as I'd love more based on a 1,000-page novel, is that there's so many moments that come at you really quick and fast, and they get to kind of cherry-pick the very best lines to highlight, so the writing goes a long way with a little. Like with Thrones, where you get really effective quotes that stick with you for ages, like "Chaos is a ladder." Here you get "Death is in our air and sea and earth. It can come for us at any moment." I'm absolutely raging there's not a season two here because I love this show so much already. It is a great addition to my Tuesday nights. But also, if this is a perfect story, you'll hear no complaints from me if they do leave it in one series. It's kind of like Watchmen in that sense, where I'm like, I really would love more because the secret sauce for this was right. They just had the correct recipe for an iconic TV show. But also, I can't criticize you for making a perfect series of television. And that's kind of the range the Shogun's in. I'm really happy to sit back for now and just enjoy the ride and not worry about all that and let everyone involved cook. Like I said, that's Shogun and you need to check it out. Anyway, guys, there's some of the shows I've been watching. Now it's time to get in depth. Let's talk some Invincible.
Mark. Nolan. Where's Nolan?
The Viltrumites took him. I'm sorry. The city, these people, it's all our fault.
Mark, You saved my life. And your brother's.
If my dad and I hadn't been here, none of this would have happened.
If your father hadn't been here, I wouldn't have a son. And if you hadn't been here, we both would have died. Thraxan lives are short compared to yours. Our culture doesn't assign blame. We only look forward. We will rebuild, Mark. Count on that.
All right, guys. Well, you may notice at the start of the show, and especially if you're watching the video, I did say we're going to be talking about Invincible with Dan Lynham and Kev Keane. And you may notice if you're looking at the video, there's only one person on screen. I'm going to take the blame for this, okay? Because Kev Keane, one of my favorite contributors we have here on Page 180, regular, excellent, always reliable. It is Paddy's weekend as we're recording this, and that's awkward and presents challenges because everyone has plans, including myself. So I asked the guys to jump on really early this morning. And Kev, I think, has probably slept it out as we record. So we're going to jump on anyway. Kev will be jumping in as we go on. He's a huge Invincible fan, and I know he's really looking forward to having the chats with us. So yeah, we're going to fly solo. But again, that's never been a problem for us because, ladies and gentlemen, joining us to discuss this week's episode of Invincible as we get started on our weekly recaps until the end of season two. It is the one, the only... Dan Lynham, very welcome back to Page 180. Dan, Invincible, obviously, we checked in on this towards the end of last year, at the end of the first four episodes of season two. Since then, I believe you've gone and done an entire reread of the series, so it's all fresh in your memory here, and you're primed for the return of Invincible, I imagine.
Very much so. I love Invincible. I've read it several times. Before we started this, we were just talking about some of our more glory days, like back on the road with Irish Whip Wrestling and the like, and then a few other wrestling stories. One constant back then for me was myself and Manson, definitely being big comic fans, we always had at least one volume of Invincible knocking around the ring van. A few of the other guys would always pick it up and read it. So that comic, as it was getting big back in the early 2000s, it was always an ever-present factor in those days. So being able to talk about it here, always wanting an Invincible TV show or a movie, it's just brilliant being back. But the fresh read-through gave me new perspective. Looking forward to discussing it.
I absolutely love it because those things, and what I love about this, and I'd love to get your take on as we do the weekly recaps, is I was reading an interview with comic creator Robert Kirkman, who's obviously heavily involved in the show. And obviously, for those who don't know, Robert Kirkman, also creator of The Walking Dead, again, you may be familiar with. He spoke about how he wanted to, like with The Walking Dead, they experimented a lot and changed a lot of storylines because they had second ideas of, oh, maybe this could go this way. And they did that. But he said, with Invincible, we've got a good thing. We don't want to fuck with it. But there's obviously challenges here. And this is what I'd love to get your thoughts on. Because again, it's not the same world. I think back to that period of time where we would have known each other back in the day. Yeah. As a different life, almost, you know, it's very 20 much years so. Ago at this stage. And like, again, it's a different world now, and that is the environment where they have to present the same story. So I wonder if there's differences. I wonder if there's kind of updates. I wonder if there's kind of rethinking. For example, one thing I know is that, like, Invincible's mom, Debbie, is obviously a much bigger factor in the show than would have, because I think they rethought how she'd look and so on. For the record, if you haven't listened to our previous chats, I own the compendium. I've started the compendium, but then I said to myself, there's some shows where, or there are some movies where you're like, I need to read the book before I watch the show. And I do get that. And I know you recommended, look, check it out. It's amazing. You'll still love the show. But for me, I made the decision here that I'm like, I fucking love this show. And the part of the show, part of an aspect that I love about the show is I love not knowing where it's going. I love the way it just moves along at its own fucking speed and does whatever the fuck it wants. And I want to know, I don't want to know who dies. I don't want to know that stuff. So I've avoided reading that, but I reserve the right to change my mind. Like if I start getting like kind of itchy feet when we're in between seasons. Guys, we are going into the spoilerverse for this episode. So you are no longer in a spoiler-free zone. We are going to be talking about everything Invincible based up to this point. We're not going to be talking, obviously, we spoke about Dan having recently done a reread of the comics. We're not going to be giving you comic book spoilers here, okay? We do want to talk with Dan because we do want to get his perspective and we can kind of tease or discuss and he can use his expertise, but as always, to kind of enhance your viewing enjoyment. Again, I don't know what's coming up in Invincible, so if Dan spoils, I'm going to be pissed, so don't worry, I'll keep him in line, guys.
It worked out, I don't know, but yeah, not anymore.
No, we're all good. So yeah, we will be talking about everything up to what you've seen. So if you haven't seen the episode, go back, rewatch it, and we're going to be diving deep into it. But before we do, as we always do, we're going to put you back into the mindset of what happened in the episode with our alternate recap and the conveniently English-speaking Thraxans find a bloody mark, still breathing while they try pick up the pieces after the Viltrumite attack. He stays for 2 months as the person his dad moved on from his ma with, asks him to take his brother home with him, which is literally the worst possible way you can come home from an exotic stray planet with a baby. That is the one way you don't want to come home with a baby. He didn't even get the ride out of it. What a waste. This left Debbie to have to live that old typical chestnut. Don't you hate it when you get home from your first day back at work after a marriage breakup to find your genocidal ex's purple grasshopper baby in your kitchen? It's the worst. Fucking Donald learns that he's a reincarnated robot. Did the fact that, like, he didn't even seem to have eyes not clue him in that there may be something wrong here? You literally left your sunglasses on while you slit your wrist, dude. How did you not, like, ask that question before, do I actually have eyes? Like, why is it immediately I'm having an existential crisis, I must slit my wrist? Take off the sunglasses. Just see if you've got eyes. That's that simple. Cecil reveals to the Guardians of the Globe that an alien ship is en route thanks to Shapesmith, wanting a holiday, basically. As Shapesmith confesses to the surprise of nobody that he is, in fact, a Martian responsible for the impending Sequid invasion. Adam Eve shows that even when you have the power to manipulate matter, your dickhead ex whispering some nice things into your ear can get you right back into old ways as seconds, as Rex convinces her to join in the fight against the Sequids. Half the team, including Mark and Eve, go off to fight the Sequids while the Lizard King picks his moment to invade while Rex is left in charge. The B team. Earth fucked. Meanwhile, in space, the hero ship is instantly blown up as they're forced to use Eve's power to sneak aboard the Martian ship, but are almost instantly overwhelmed by Sequids. Space fucked. Duplicate is double annihilated. Ray is literally eaten alive. Rex is left with a gun to his head from the Lizard King, while the A team seem ready to be consumed by the Sequids. All hope seems lost until, in a post-credit scene, Alan wakes up. He's Jack now and greeted by Thaddeus, who revealed himself by merely taking off his beard in one fell stroke. I feel that people should have asked more questions there too. He revealed himself to be a rebel Viltrumite, told him he needed to cut Alan's life support to make him a threat to the Viltrumites and to go find Invincible, who's their best hope in the wars to come. And just like that, ladies and gentlemen, we are fucking back. That's Invincible Season 2, Episode 5. This must come as a shock. Dan, talk me through it. Your thoughts on Episode 5.
Great starter. Knowing that they're sticking with the comics, it was really exciting to know where they were going. And the one thing, especially with that post-credit scene, is you were really, really bummed last season when Alan died. So, and you were like, oh no, what's going to happen here? And I just wanted to tell you. This is something that is kind of interesting with Alan. It's that, like, you know, every time he experiences this thing, he does get stronger. Not as much a spoiler. It's just something that becomes a constant. It's kind of central to his character. I think everyone's kind of figured it out by now. Really, really good episode. There was a few changes to the comics, which Ooh. I thought was very interesting. Very minor, but it was an interesting one because they have given some of the characters slightly different beats. Okay. Which I definitely found interesting. A very second part of the show, very faithful to the comics and really, really interesting. But definitely a big solid jump back in. My brain kind of knows where they're going to finish this season and where they're going to go. And it's just some of the more exciting parts of the story for me. So I'm really, really looking forward to it. It was a really good start. And the way they portrayed some stuff from the comics into the visual medium, worked a treat. The sequence went from that stupid little brain thing that we've seen parodied in a million sci-fi movies into the genuine threat that they are, on a more kind of horror level than sci-fi, which was brilliant. So great starter episodes. Well, for our new season, for a mid-season, but great episode nonetheless.
Yeah, I love this. I thought this was a nice... I just like being in this universe. It's so fulfilling in so many ways. It takes so many boxes at the same time. It was a really nice resetting the scene episode to kind of check back in with everyone, which is mad considering the decision to split the season in two was made like after the season was made. It wasn't written that way. It was because of the writer's strike. Amazon just needed to spread out content to keep the subscribers hooked because they didn't know when they'd have more content. So it's mad that it worked out that way, but it really, really did. I love... What I think I like the most about this, as mad as it sounds, is because it's something that you put far down the list, but I love the humor and the charm of this because at its peak, it kind of remains one of the best TV shows on today. Like you had Shamesmith kind of confessing he was a Martian and he's like, are you ready for this ever? We know you're a Martian. That's it. We know. And the fact that Black Samson didn't know as well. Like it's like, you all knew what, like, why would they not talk to him? It was just great crack. And again, it's kind of the benefit to having you know, Seth Rogen is one of the main kind of instigators in this. He plays Alan, but he's also one of the executive producers of this, and like all of his projects have that kind of charm and humor and everyday feel that makes it kind of that makes it interesting. And I joked in kind of the alt recap about the tracks and speaking English, and everyone in this can speak English, and look, it's a plot device and that's fine, but like you don't care because it just feels everyday anyway in its tone, and that's something that I like. You have kind of grade A comic stars like Jason Mantzoukas and Ben Schwartz, and that really keeps it likable. Like I love the line where Rex is like, and I want to talk more about Rex, but like where he's like, to fuck up is human, everybody does it, Shakespeare said that. Brilliant. But Ben Schwartz, even as Shakespeare, like he can do so much more comedically than Shakespeare does, but he maximizes how funny Shakespeare is, if that makes sense. There is a lot going on though. And look, I'm not against that because you then throw back to something like, again, I always kind of wondered what's going to happen with the sequins because they really built that up as if this happens, everyone's fucked. And then you kind of forgot about it. And then they brought it back up and I'm like, okay, that's the way this show is. It will just plant seeds and then they'll just get back to it when you least expect it and use it as kind of a twist. So I like that, that there's so much going on. And as well, like kind of as we discussed in the last kind of recap about this, that means that it's going to last a long time. Like yeah. Kirkman is talking 7-8 series and you talked like kind of they could do much more even. But there are, for me, the only critique I'd have of this, and it doesn't kind of override my enjoyment of the show, is there are full subplots in this that feel like they're stalling or just not really worth giving a shit about. Now, maybe they will be in the long run, but just like Adam Eve, I suppose, in the first half of the season, I know she got back to it this like in this season, but or in this episode, or Donald's entire fucking storyline. Who cares? We never cared about Donald when we thought he was a human. Why would we care when he's not? And like, it's not that I don't like those type of stories. Like, for example, we've got X-Men 97 coming out this Wednesday. So I'm rewatching all of the X-Men animated series for the first time since I was a kid. And I fucking love it. And you know what? Like, I'm all about, like, because it's a very baggy series. There's so many episodes because it was mass produced. Like, it was made for like every daily for kids to watch every day after school.
I think there was three studios involved, so they were, you could see different animation shifts, and the story seems disenfranchised, so yeah, you're right, it was really, like, thrown at us in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah, but you don't actually mind, like, this morning, you don't mind them kind of faffing about for an episode that isn't connected to the main plot. Like, this morning I was watching the episode where they're kind of underwater with Omega Red, and again, like, it's a total self-contained episode. Yeah, exactly, it's total self-contained, and it's just, like, you know, extra content. But when we only get four episodes at a time here, I'm sitting through the scenes, like, move along, guys. We don't have much time here. You know, I don't want to not care about things. But then as I'm thinking about all of this, they just turn it up to 11 in that way. Only Invincible and the boys can. And fuck me. Incredible action. Absolutely vicious deaths of big characters. Savage twists. All kind of following its own unique rhythm and pace. The Invincible we all know and love is fucking back, lads. And I'm so happy. Dan, I want to kind of dig into something you said there. You spoke about how there's key differences with some character beats here. I'd love to know that, because obviously it's a difference, so it's not a spoiler talking about it, but what differences did you notice in this episode?
Well, it's really interesting seeing as how you brought up the Donald thing, because in the comic books, this subplot they're doing with Donald isn't really there. He is well aware he's a robot, and as the story goes on in the comics, which he won't be doing in the TV show, a lot of the rehabilitated reanimen, Donald is a kind of PTSD mentor for them. You know, he talks about his experience, and he helps them kind of through it. And I know it seems like they could still do that, like Donald will come to accept that, but it didn't play out the same way. So I don't think that's the way they're going. At the same time, as small as it is, there's a different subplot with Shapesmith, which you're definitely not going to explore, where you find that he was part of a faction on Mars that wanted the Sequids to have their own independence. He wanted to stop using them as slaves. And they were involved in how the Sequids actually ended up infecting the astronaut, which, you know, caused all this trouble. So the guys he meets up with on the ship when they board it, they're all very responsible for what happened. So the thing with Donald's just didn't kind of land with me. I was like, it's strange they're going with this, seeing as how his character is a little bit stronger in the comics. When they have this other option, which is, you know, the kind of idea of doing something morally good, but having it backfire on you, wasn't really approached. So this inversion of these two stories was kind of weird. And for me, it's not really a negative on the show. It was still an absolutely brilliant episode. It just didn't really land. I don't see why they went for this thing that you've already mentioned you weren't really that interested in. Whereas even though the sequence thing is very small, it might have read better on the screen. So strange way to go.
Donald, and I was going to kind of ask that question. I was going to be like, don't tell me, but is there anything to look forward to with Donald? And it's interesting that you don't know, like, and they've kind of, that's been a shift they've made. And I think it's part of it. Like, I joked in the alt recap about, like, we never even see his eyes. Like, he's just always wearing sunglasses. But that is to signify how generic of a background kind of man in black he is. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's that guy. And again, like, his character is so insignificant. He doesn't have eyes. Like, again, they just can't be arsed drawing eyes for him. And then we're asked to care about his existential crisis, which, again, it's fine. Like, it's interesting. Like, I could see, like, again, you're talking about kind of, you know, the reanimated endoskeletons and stuff like that as well, where they've kind of saved the brain. And there is interesting things you can parse from there, because, you know, Cecil at one point said, you know, he kind of mentioned every time, like, as if this happens a few times and this is the latest in occurrence of him, like kind of Westworld, where, you know, they'd have that, like, they'd get towards consciousness and they'd basically just click the reset button in their head. And again, that's just kind of the life cycle that they have. So that's interesting, I suppose, but I don't care. And it's just that they're telling me not to care by even the design of the character that is tough to go on. But again, that is my only real nitpick with what was an excellent episode. What I love about this is how grounded it is in reality and how it stays grounded in reality. And unlike a lot of comics, like, comics can suffer when they do this. It's like George R. R. Martin, and like, even like fantasy and sci-fi stories as well. It's like George R. R. Martin trying to write sex scenes. You know, it's just like bag of sand. It's like, have you ever had sex, George? Like, it doesn't seem based off your sex scene that you have. Like, and sometimes, like, comic book, when they try to ground themselves in reality, they can actually move further away from it and it can disconnect you. But this does stay connected. The characters sound like they're talking in real life. And that's why I love the stories that they have, and the decisions that they make. For example, Mark and having to bring his brother home. Farewell, I think it looks like we're saying to the great Rhea Seahorn, an amazing casting option, by them bringing on fucking Kim Wexler onto this show. Everyone is on this show. But she obviously asked Invincible to bring his brother home, which presented Debbie with a kind of dilemma. This got me thinking about real life conversations of, like, what would you do? Like, if you're Mark there, you kind of have to bring them home, but also, would you leave it with your mom? Like, that's fucked up. If you're Debbie, what would you do? Let's have this conversation, because I'm just very interested, because it just got me thinking.
The medium of comics versus TV show is always going to provide different narrative beats, obviously. And it landed a lot better in the comics because of one key factor. In the show, we just seen what happens. We go into the next episode. We don't need to recap that detailed. In the comics, between where the Traxxan genocide happens, and I keep going to say the baby's name. I'm just going to refer to it as the baby because I'm going to be really good on spoilers.
Okay, thank you.
So, between when the Traxxan thing happens, the baby and Mark leave and then come back to Earth where Debbie's told the story. You are given more of a recap there. It's the story being fresher as opposed to this gap where, the exposition happens between Mark and Debbie. That made the story just kind of land a little better because she had a more of a refresher. And the way she bonded with the baby, nearly did it again. The way she bonded with the baby in the comics as well was a lot more heartfelt. So it worked out better just because of the medium. Because I did feel that as well, that I was like, this is a big ask. And it's weird because it doesn't feel like that she's accepting it. I think that's why something they didn't do in the comics as much, they did it in a different way. Cecil seems interested in taking the baby, whereas in the comics, it wasn't really a thing. They just gave Mark a bit of assistance and that was it. It was never brought up again. So I think the whole thing with Cecil is a way of maybe making Debbie more protective so their bond can form. So that's what I'm thinking.
I see it's kind of like Werner Herzog in The Mandalorian, the baby. Let me hold
Baby.
the baby. Well, what we'll do is, right, we'll call it Om the Baby for now, and then we'll kind of figure it out as the name gets revealed. I may have just guessed it one, but I don't know. Don't tell me
Shockingly close. You didn't get it, but that is impressive.
if I have. So yeah, like it was interesting. I thought this really landed because it got to that part of my brain that's going, what would I do? And what should Debbie do? Like, because I was like, you gotta give it to Cecil, because, and I think they had to add that, and maybe that's a if they didn't address that in the comics, I think that's a 2024 sensibility that they needed to address, such as like fleshing out Debbie a lot more than they did there. And I think, like, again, it's Debbie's choice. It's Debbie's kind of burden to bear, because Mark's loyalties, it's still his brother. He still has the connection. That baby is nothing to, that's Jon Snow to Catelyn Stark, the baby just is nothing. I loved some of the scripting used for this. Like, you had Mark kind of thinking, he's my brother, I can't abandon him. And then Debbie just with the little dig. I fucking love Debbie as a character. Like, I love how, like, the little things she does with her and the little choices, she just seems so real and relatable in a way I'm just not used to from a story of this kind of genre. Like, she gets the bottle of wine from work, and there's that suggestion that the guy that drops her home may be a bit interested in her, and that's a potential love interest and blah blah blah. But they don't kind of go anywhere with it. They just show us his face and go from there. And she gets in, and obviously all we've seen her do since kind of what Nolan did is drink wine, and who can blame her? But then she kind of thinks about if she's going to pour a glass, and she's like, no, I'm not going to. And then the next scene, when she, after she meets Om the Baby, she's drinking wine because she's like, I need a fucking glass. You know what I mean? So she's trying to get better and so on. But I love the line that she shot back with, because again, she's spiteful. She's angry. And at all stages, you remember this. When he says, I can't just abandon him, she goes, oh, you must get that from my side of the family. I'm like, yeah, that's how you'd be. You'd be like, you're trying to be nice, you're trying to be supportive, but you're still so fucking angry and bitter. And her character just has such depth. I think for me, I'd give it to Cecil. I'm like, maybe Mark doesn't want to do that, because again, he knows what Cecil's going to do, kind of raise it as, the next kind of world's beating kind of, savior hero. And what life will that entail? But from Debbie's standpoint, I'm like, I've got no love for this baby. It's purple. It's not even the same species as me. So, like, how can I, so I don't know. It's really interesting though. I want to talk about Rex. I want to show some love for Rex, because Rex was phenomenal in this episode. I fucking love him. He may now be my favorite character in this show, and I am all in on the redemption arc. And I wasn't surprised then when they kind of gave him again, like it's a Walking Dead trope. It's even in wrestling, like in a Royal Rumble or in like an elimination match, when someone kind of fires up and starts to kind of have a big shine, you know, they're getting eliminated soon. So I wasn't surprised when he ended it with a gun to his head, because again, they gave him a lot to work with. But I love the redemption arc. I hope that we have a lot low, like we have a lot longer with him. Obviously, don't think he's gonna die. If he was gonna die, they would have just killed him here. Don't tell me, but like, let's talk about Rex and his redemption arc. I loved his speech to Adam Eve. I loved him being like nice and genuine. Getting the gang together, coordinating the flight to space. But I love how they don't sell him out either and just have him be like a nice guy now. He's still an arsehole. He's still arrogant. He's still a prick. He gives Adam Eve this like genuinely nice kind of motivational speech. And then she's like, what do you want? And he's like, well, actually, I do want something. Or then he coordinates and motivates everyone to go to space. And he's like, yeah, let's wait till those losers get back, as if anything else is going to happen. He's still hilarious. And Jason Mantzoukas is playing the shit out of him, I know, because he's like very much like us. He's a massive nerd. He's into these type of stories. He is loving this. He is loving his life being cast as Rex. And he's nailing it. But what are your thoughts on Rex as a whole and everything we kind of saw and the bit of redemption we got?
One thing I'd also say to prefix this is Invincible is very interesting in one way that you don't really see most comics explore, whereas just coming off my fresh read through, when you finish a certain amount, you can actually see that transition of time that happens. It's like, you know, when you watch a TV show and then you go back and you watch a bit of season one and you're like, everyone looks so young. Invincible really did that quite well. Like, obviously, when it was written, there was an idea to not do the typical comic trope of keep everyone the same age since the 1960s, maybe like give them like a half a decade. But with Invincible, when you're like halfway through and you look back, everyone seems so young. So to see this evolution in Rex's character, to see him essentially grow up, they've done it really, really well, because Rex is and has been a fan favorite, which is it is crucial to kind of where the story goes, just having him loved. So the way they have him basically maturing here and in the comic up to this point, there was signs of regret on his part and how childish he was. So they're really kind of squeezing this into this here. And I always loved Rex, but you're like, you know, it's kind of like the way we always talk, like Stan Lee wrote Tony Stark as a self-imposed test, see if he could write an asshole, make everyone love them. And that's exactly what Rex Blood is here. And I'd like to see this kind of transition with him now. He has turned the page. And the whole scene with the Lizard League was pretty much panel for panel to the comics. But another thing here, which is very controversial at the time, is they change one thing that the fans were unhappy with, which was Shrinking Ray's death.
Right.
So in the comics, Shrinking Ray is explored as much as they are in the TV show. It's kind of a background character. But the scene where he's eaten, because he's gender swapped in the TV show and comics, that was it. Bang. Swallowed. Comical strip. Done. And everyone was like, everyone, like, you know, kind of like had a big send off, including the original Guardians of the Globe, which we saw in season one, which is about issue 10 in the comics. And the first Shrinking Ray just be killed like that was terrible. So the fact that they made her death in the TV show more obvious, more grotesque, because people are kind of waiting for Shrinking Ray to pop back up, but they really showed to be killed, or like she got mushed and bled out, was a bit of a redemption, because that was something that really sat bad with the fans at the time. So to see that change, I know we're deviating from the Rex thing, but it's just something I was really happy that they approached. So this has got me thinking, the stuff that is still to come that the fans weren't big on, are they going to use this new medium as a way to rewrite a lot of stuff that the time fans were like, bad decision, why did they do that? It's a little snippet into the future, but that allows me to think about some stuff that's coming up. Maybe some stuff with Rex, I'm not going to say, but the rules are kind of being rewritten. And for people like me who knows what's coming, that's exciting. I'm just like, you know, I'm happy that like he had that moment. I think people are starting to see them as the. It kind of reminds me of the older douchebag brother in Weird Science. Now they may not turn him into a poo monster, but you do at the end of the movie realize you kind of grow to like him. He's a bit misunderstood. Another great one is, God, that movie Sex Drive. I can't remember the character's name or the actor, but how you just like these older brother douchebag characters as it goes on, you can kind of see why they're such an arsehole and get on their side. And that's what Rex is doing now, and it's working great.
Nice. Yeah, big into again. If we throw back to my X-Men rewatch, I was only watching Juggernaut Returns the other day. It's very similar vibes. Yeah, so I like it. I love kind of the what's really interesting about that change was obviously I didn't know about, but they really fucking killed Ray. That makes sense of how vicious the death was because it was fucking disgusting. The sound effects were like you could hear the crunches, you could hear Ray being digested during that. And like again, it makes a lot of sense in the scene knowing how they played it now, knowing what it was like in the comic, because again, you have that Rex go, haha, you didn't realize it could get bigger. And they're kind of doing that Ant-Man Thanos theory. They're kind of playing that out. But
For anyone who hasn't seen that, I recommend just going to Google. You won't get any spoilers. Shrinking Ray Death in comics. It is literally one panel. And yourself and everyone watching this today, go have a look at that now and see how different that was, and you'll get it. It's quite important, I think.
Interesting. But like, yeah, again, like she kind of is powering up, and again, you sense, oh, I know what's gonna happen here. And then he just goes, no, do you know what? It's like a particularly tough bit of steak. You just double down and hump. And it's like, oh shit. Especially after like they've been so vicious with Duplicate as well. He was a character that like has had quite a lot to do, and that's a significant death. I love the point that you made though, and the show's really good. I was only thinking that myself at showing the passage of time, like. And showing the impact of time passing in very subtle but meaningful ways. Like at the start of the episodes, we had like, you know, Mark spent 2 months is later what we learned on Thraxa helping them rebuild. But then, like, you know, by the time he's leaving, essentially, the Empress is ready to die. And they'd signaled that in the previous episode that they've got very short lifespans. And that's how like they were able to have a child and stuff like that as well with Nolan. But again, that was really effective. But also when he got back then, 2 months has passed in Earth time. And again, while that's not as big of a deal here, stuff can still happen in 2 months. And Amber mentions her grandfather died. And he wasn't there for any of that. And then he feels awful as a result. So really effective. And I'm glad that it's something that the show takes time for. I mentioned Game of Thrones a lot. I think it's because I'm watching Shogun. But like I think that was something that it did quite poorly towards the end. So I appreciate when shows actually make an effort to do it. Let's talk about we've already touched on it, but let's talk about kind of the two battles at the end and when it really dialed up to 11. Was this what you were expecting? Did it live up to the hype? And what were your general thoughts on kind of on everything that kind of transpired? Like we'll touch on Alan separately, but as far as this goes.
Not really kind of like knowing what was going on at the start of the episode with like the few minor changes. Another thing that I want to mention just is how different Adam Eve's, what would you say, like her composure is in the show versus the comics. She's a lot more strong-willed and she's a bit more outspoken. Strange thing is, I would like almost invert her everyday character with Amber. In the TV shows, the way they are in the comics, Amber is a bit flakier in the comics. Eve's a lot more headstrong, and it does feel like that the characters have been inverted. So I don't know what they're doing. Obviously, they know they have a plan in place, and I'm just interested to see where it's going. But aside from that, it was pretty much panel for panel. Eve is a bit more aggressive in the comics when it comes to the actual sequence fight. She really uses her powers in an interesting way to create weapons and swords and change up her armor. But apart from that, they kind of nailed it. I already mentioned how the sequence they went for a more Lovecraftian horror elements, which really, really worked because something like that can come off as hokey sci-fi nonsense. And then the underground bunker silo fight, which obviously we've touched on how gory it was. Invincible kind of established itself in the comics very slowly compared to the show as to how visceral it was. Even like the first episode, like the whole thing, it's like, this is for kids, and then the Guardian scene just shuts that down completely. And I'd say there's some parents who are definitely paying a lot of psychiatrist bills right now for their kids who thought they were going to be watching like Ben 10 or something like that, and it turned out to be just this incredibly violent TV show. And yeah, they're like, poor little kids are traumatized. But the violence does play into a big part. And then as the comic evolves, especially written by someone like Kurtman and Ryan Ottley, who is an executive producer as well, who did, I think around issue 8, did start becoming the main artist. And Ottley has this amazing ability to really make you feel every punch. He's a great visual storyteller. So the violence has to be turned up in the show to reflect how every single punch landed in the comic, because in a medium like comic books, you can make something that happens over a second last several pages.
Yeah,
I think we talked about that before, that the second last issue of the Battle Royale comic, the manga, this 150, 200 page book, you can argue happens over the space of 15 seconds. And so when you're in comics and you can really spend that time to make like someone's broken ribs or make it like a punch feel earth shattering, you need to kind of up that in the TV show by making it extremely violent. So the violence seems nonsensical sometimes, but if you've come off reading the books, it does give it that invincible feel. And the nuclear silo thing did that really, really well.
I love when Invincible gets like this. And it actually, it's funny you bring up the first episode, because this reminded me of the first episode. It's like the vibe you're feeling. And again, we've been 3 months away, which is arguably way too long for us to have been away from this. Not just because we're fans, but because you need to keep momentum of the story going. But they got back in, and like, again, it kind of had that episode one vibe where I'm like, oh, this is cute. These are really charming. This is really clever. I like this. I'm not mad about that Donald stuff, but it's fine. Like, everything else is great. And you're kind of at that stage where you're like, this is a good 7 or 8 out of 10 TV show episode. And then, holy fuck. Yeah. And I love that. How visceral is the word you use? And it's a word I'll kind of double down on. It's incredible. I liked it. I liked how tongue-in-cheek this show is as well, where they're like, the Lizard League is lame. And then, like, they're actually, what's after happening? Why are they good? I think that's interesting. Why are they able to now tear them apart? Okay, yeah, granted, they only had 3 heroes left to fight. There's intrigue there as well, because, again, we didn't see the gun being fired at Rex, so I would assume Rex is going to be fine. But then there's that intrigue of who can save him? Like, who's around to kind of stop that bullet being pulled, or that gun being fired. So what's gonna happen? Like, kind of there. So it's intriguing. Like, again, the sequence, I thought kind of it was something that stuck with me and I was waiting for. It lived up to the billing. I would have liked more of it, if I'm being honest. Maybe we'll get more next week. It certainly doesn't look like it's close to being resolved, though. Again, you'd kind of imagine like Alan has been sent there. So if I'm speculating, I'd imagine that there's a Deus Ex Alan coming their way. I don't know, though. Don't tip me. Don't tip me if that's the case. So, like, I'm intrigued. The only thing that I kind of say is, again, time. I'm very conscious we only get 8 episodes of this, okay? Yeah. And I'm like, we know that ultimately the Viltrumites and or Omni-Man are the big bads here. They're the final bosses, okay? We know that Angstrom Levy is probably someone that we need to be aware of and pay attention to in the shorter term. And maybe it's the big boss of this series. Maybe not. I don't know. But again, kind of these are two relatively minor characters. So I'm worried about the pacing of the show. I'm like, there's a to be continued here. So I'm suggesting this is a 2-episode arc, and that's fine. Yeah. Again, in X-Men, when you've got 19 episodes, you're fine with that. Give me a 5-episode arc. I'm grand. It's not the arc that I'm worried about, because again, I think there's enough story here to tell, but it's the amount of time you're devoting essentially half of these to outcomes. We know, like, again, there may be deaths here, and we got duplicate dying here. You know, there, you know, if there's people that are on the table, there's a lot of kind of extra kind of red shirt guardians of the globe that they've thrown in recently who could turn out to be someone or could turn out to be just be people that they kill. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see people die, but I don't think anyone massive is going to die in the next 2 weeks. So I'm like, do we need to spend half of the series on this arc when we know kind of the outcome here? And that's kind of where I'm at. And again, I may feel completely different next week. It's the only thing that I kind of took away from it. And maybe you could fill me in on if that's the case. But I also want to touch on Alan and the revelation, which I found really funny because it's like, first off, I don't know, like, yeah, like I was gutted when kind of it seemed like they did kill Alan. I'm glad he's still alive because I felt that they set up his story well enough that we didn't get enough of him, so I'm okay with it. Like, even if it felt a bit cheap to just bring him back and be like, haha, actually when I did an evil thing, I actually did a good thing. Thaddeus's reveal, again, I'm fine with the overall revelation, so I am more nitpicking, but Thaddeus's reveal where it's like the only thing that stopped him from being like a Viltrumite was just a bit of extra hair here. Yeah. I'm just like, no one asked any questions, but whatever, I'm fine. I'll roll with it. And it's just a funny kind of meme-y thing. What were your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, so like the Alan thing, once again, looking at the comics and looking at how things kind of went, it was different. One, Thaddeus doesn't actually like kill Alan in the comics the way he did in this, you know, shoot up as a life support machine. That in the same comic that we had the Alan special, that one ends up with him waking up,
right,
realizing he's stronger. So it was obviously done. It felt a little bit cheap, to be honest. Yeah. It was like, and it, you know, kind of to give us that red herring and kind of veer a certain way. So once again, I think that just kind of like suffers from the switch in storytelling medium. The beard thing, which is great because you talked about earlier, the humor of Invincible. And as Invincible goes on in the comics, it's something that's able to laugh at itself. So this is something that happens, but it's not a spoiler. It's just in reference to what you said, which is at a later date, a character says to Thaddeus, prove that you're a Voltramite. Please conduct a ceremonial Voltramite beard pulling. And he's like, no, I've done it enough times already. It hurts. So the beard pulling thing, I'm glad you picked up on that because people are going to go, that's hokey. It becomes an in-joke. It's something that they're able to laugh at.
Yeah.
And because I think that in the comics, it looked like he was wearing a fake beard, but in this one, they just went for the, oh no, Voltramites grow beards and it's just a thing to prove that they're undercover.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that they went with that, but they do address it as it goes on.
That's really funny.
But yeah, like there's a lot of Viltrumite stuff that I'm just so excited about that I would love to go on about. There's, I'm not trying to think, I'm not going to give anything away. There's two Viltrumite characters we haven't seen yet that are two of my favorite characters, and I'm just dying to see how they're introduced and if they have the same impact.
Okay.
I think we talked about one before and I didn't go into it. One is very one-dimensional, but he's very good at what he does. And then there's another element that is just, it really changes the game. So I'm not giving anything away, but what you think you know, there is so much more. So if you're excited about the show, yourself, Jer, or as the fans, and you like where they're going with the Viltrumite stuff, buckle in, because there's stuff you have no idea about, and there are going to be revelations.
Okay.
So not necessarily pull up to a solid time, because I hate that people say, oh, there's a twist coming. That's enough of a spoiler for me sometimes. There's going to be stuff that takes you in a different direction that worked really well the first time around, and I can only imagine it's going to work great this time as well.
I think you've definitely set me up and got me intrigued. And I'm not giving anything away there. Like, we don't know much about Viltrumites anyway. It was jarring to see Viltrumites in the last one because I'm like, I don't know how this works. I don't know what they look like fighting each other and stuff like that as well. So we've got very, very little. They're almost, again, to go back to Game of Thrones, they're almost like the White Walkers. You know, they're more spoken about than seen or understood or acknowledged. So yeah, exciting times, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to these conversations. Don't worry, Dan. Week by week, you're going to get to discuss more as we go on. And we'll parse that out, that wisdom.
This is your fault, because you have this setup here where we get to talk spoiler-free about stuff, which no one does anymore. But now that we're doing comics, And I would
Super
think I'm good at
spoilers.
exactly. It's like I can spoil certain things, but I have to cut myself off at a certain
Yeah,
point. So you've set me up for failure.
we're all good. We're all good. Excited as always. And next week, I promise that we'll record at a time that is past Kev's alarm. So don't worry. We'll make sure we get Kev back on because I want to check in with his thoughts too. Dan, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Page 180. And chat next week about Invincible all over again. That's all the time we have this week on Page 180. Next week on the show, we're back for episode 6 and the third last episode of season 2 of Invincible. I hate these miniseries. It ends so quickly. Dan and Kev will be back in the hot seat for that. But until then, this has been Page 180, and I've been Jer Leggett, and everyone fucks up. To fuck up is human. Shakespeare said that.